Well, I can't tell you how nice it is to give a talk in person for a change. For the last 2 years, it's been Zoom or whatever else, but it's nice to see everybody. Nice to be back here. The conversation on COVID, of course, was 2 years ago. We left this conference. My daughter got sick while she was here, laying on a couch for a week with a high fever and cough and respiratory symptoms, and went back home, and then all of a sudden we discovered that everybody had COVID. And so it was a little bit of a surprising thing to be part of. Going to talk a little bit about terminating cardiac arrest care, not really related to COVID, but certainly there's parts of it as well. And let's see if I can get this started. And objectives, just talk a little bit about when do we terminate cardiac arrest in the field and in the emergency department. This is a topic that, of course, I think actually Brian did the same talk last, a similar talk last year, although I'm sure it wasn't as good as Brian's. But that all of the guys in our department, all the medics, turns into an important issue for us. We won't talk about people with pre-existing pulses or kids or EMS systems with ECMO programs. So the funny thing about field termination is it's one of those things that you're never wrong, is that if you think that the patient's dead and you pronounce them, they stay dead. And if you think you work them, then they're more likely to have a chance at resuscitation. So it's sort of the ultimate decision-making where you make a decision and stick with it. And of course, when you pronounce somebody dead, usually they stay that way. Just a little bit of background. This is data out of the CARES Cardiac Arrest Registry to Enhance Care Network from annual report, and you'll see that there's approximately 40% of patients, the first bar, they have evidence efforts to resuscitate patients on scene terminated. So this is a increasing frequency of thing that happens across systems in the United States and is important for us to know about. Just giving you a little better sense, and this is our earlier data from probably about 2014 to 17, what happens to patients that are transported to the emergency department with CPR in progress, and of course the vast majority of them die. That's no surprise to any of you. It's probably why emergency physicians have a jaundiced eye on the whole issue of cardiac arrest, is that they come in, they've got CPR, EMS did everything already, and then they bring them in and we pronounce them. And so what's the point? But certainly there is a small percentage of people that come in with resuscitation ongoing in the department and end up leaving the hospital alive, but not very many. And it begs the experience that that's why we should be pronouncing them on scene. Why do that? Well, once you start moving a patient, anybody that's had the experience of doing a CPR from somebody that comes into the front door of the ER and you run out and pull them out of a car or a cab, put them on a stretcher, do CPR while you're moving down the hall, trying to bag them, try to do all of those things during a resuscitation. Well, if you do that in the field, it's suboptimal. Trying to move a patient with CPR in progress is not effective resuscitation. Any of you that have ever ridden with EMS while you're doing CPR, and you're trying to hold on one of the bars up ahead, and you're trying to do CPR with one hand, you're probably not doing anything for the patient, and you're also a sitting duck if you get broadsided by a car. So resuscitation en route to the hospital is not good for the patient, and it's probably not good for the provider. The asterisk, of course, is more and more people are using Lucas devices, which have changed at least the quality of CPR that gets done. I'm not sure that it's changed. In fact, the literature is that there isn't a change in outcomes based on provision of a Lucas device. Public health concerns, of course, is the issue of safety of the medics, and then going lights and sirens when you're flying down a highway or a major road near a hospital during CPR is a risk for the community. So particularly, these are reasons that we probably should be terminating resuscitations at home. For the individual patient, there's some interesting literature that's evolved, first by Brian Grinnell from Vancouver, who compared patients with field resuscitation and tail-risk versus patients that had early intra-arrest transport. And I'm sure a number of your EMS systems snatch patients, shock them a couple of times, try to put down a supraglottic airway, maybe start an IV, maybe drill an IO, give a couple doses of drugs, and then run to the hospital. This was data from the ROC Consortium and identified that patients that had resuscitation, work them till they die, on scene, work them to death on scene, had better outcomes, both in all patients that had resuscitation, in shockable and non-shockable subgroups, and in propensity match groups, that patients that had prolonged focused resuscitation on scene do better than patients that have a suboptimal or incomplete resuscitation and intra-arrest transport. Interestingly enough, another group out of Pennsylvania looked at the CARES registry and looked at stratified EMS agencies whether they did more intra-arrest transport versus field resuscitation and field termination. And those EMS agencies that work patients till death on the scene had better outcomes across the board compared to agencies that had low rates of field resuscitation and field termination. So again, the concept of increasing quality of resuscitation on scene, giving the medics license to, you're gonna do what we're gonna do in the emergency department unless we're gonna put you on ECMO, and your outcomes should be better. So I think there's patient level and system level data that supports this concept. So pretty much these are not surprising to any of you, I'm sure, as there's field decision rules that have been developed that are part of the AHA 2020 standards, have been since 2010, 2015. And basically it's as if you don't get ROSC on scene, if they had no bystander CPR, if it wasn't a witnessed arrest, and if there was no shock delivered, then those patients are candidates for field termination. And BLS systems, a number of systems across the country just have BLS care that are augmented by ALS, but not enough, they don't have enough ALS resources, is that if there's no ROSC, no witnessed arrest, no AED shock anytime during the resuscitation, those patients can be terminated as well. Those resuscitations can be terminated. It's a lousy slide, but this is the 2020 guidelines, but basically is part of, just illustrates that this is part of guidelines 2020. And same is true for ALS, and these have increasing support in the literature. The literature is all over the place. There's a lot of international studies from Korea and Japan. Those EMS systems are fundamentally different, both in their willingness to terminate care or withdraw care in the hospital, and what care they provide in the field without advanced life support care other than perhaps intramuscular or intravenous epinephrine and transport. And so I think looking at the international studies, mostly the Pacific Rim studies, are not as quite as relevant to what we do on a day-to-day basis. And these are older studies from Toronto, from Dr. Camilla Sasson using CARES data, and all of these studies showing that the quality of those clinical ALS and BLS decision rules are really quite good and are quite sensitive for failed resuscitation, of course, with the ring, with death. With the caveat, of course, is that when you make the decision to terminate care, those patients tend not to live. This also, Dr. Morrison identified in the bottom slide, part of the slide here, 54% decreased transport. So large decrease in transport rates for patients in the field under those circumstances. And these are the guidelines from Heart Association 2020. And if you look at them, they have some surprising things that they not only use basic failure to ROSC, no shock, no witnessed arrest. They look at end-tidal CO2 in the field as a means to use to identify futility of resuscitation. with end-tidal CO2 capnography less than 10 millimeters, with the caveat that that's not true for supraglottic airways, which are increasingly used in the field. So we have some difficulty with interpreting end-tidal CO2, and then looking at point-of-care ultrasound for prognostication, which is not recognized as having benefit, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. That's where we were until March of 2020, and then things changed, as all of you know. Once COVID came and we started looking at this horrible infectious disease that we didn't know what the implications of this were, we didn't know what the potential was for taking it home to friends and family and coworkers. We didn't know how much aerosolization was available. We didn't have adequate PPE for periods of time. And so there were interim guidelines that came out through the Heart Association and a number of other professional organizations with the goals of minimizing aerosolization, protecting providers, and considering the appropriateness of starting and continuing resuscitation. So appropriateness of starting resuscitation to someone with COVID and in cardiac arrest. This, of course, early on in the pandemic, particularly in southeastern Michigan, where I'm from, is that we didn't have good testing. I mean, we were very good at getting tests back in patients in 4, 5, 6 days. And so you have somebody that's a cardiac arrest that had a clinical syndrome consistent with COVID or thought might be COVID, then you're really having to make a decision as to what's the right thing for your providers. So we didn't have PPE uniformly. When you started resuscitation, it wasn't just put your N95 on and put a mask over top of it. It was, you know, put on the whole body condom. It was opening the windows of the ambulance. It was limiting the number of personnel on scenes so that all of a sudden, for the first time since I've ever started, is we had resuscitations in the ER where there were only the people that you needed as opposed to 20 people in the emergency department doing a resuscitation, that we cleared everybody out of the resuscitation. We avoided endotracheal intubation in the field to a large degree, and probably in the emergency department, with limited numbers at our institution, we had anesthesiologists with PAPRs and their own special glide scope, et cetera, and triple gloving, and took them 15 minutes to make a decision to intubate somebody. It was going back 50 years in practice. But all of those things happened early on in COVID. And we told the medics, we don't want you to transport somebody if they've got COVID. If somebody arrests en route to the hospital and they've got COVID, we want you to pull over the side of the road, open the doors, open the windows, and do the resuscitation. And if you don't have return of spontaneous circulation, pronounce them there in the field, which was a little crazy. And they disabused us about that notion fairly quickly, but that's where we were not that terribly long ago. And it was, somebody has COVID, they're a cardiac arrest, you shock them, you do 10 minutes of CPR, you don't get return of spontaneous circulation, and those patients were pronounced. So it really changed fundamentally how we did all this. There's some early data of the first stage of the pandemic out of the CARES registry as well, looking at the first wave of the pandemic and rates of RASC, rates of termination of resuscitation, rates of survival to discharge. And you can see as the incidence of COVID deaths per million population, that the rate of termination of resuscitation on scene went up accordingly. This isn't necessarily patients with COVID, but once we had large numbers of COVID patients in our communities, we stopped doing effective resuscitation. So it was a fundamental change in how this worked. And that's a better view of how much we increased our field termination rates over the early part of the pandemic. Just to tell you where we are now, every state has its own approach to doing EMS guidelines. And and model protocols. I think about 13 states have statewide protocols for EMS in general, but for field resuscitation and termination of resuscitation as well. This is our draft model protocols from the National Association of State EMS Officials. So the state EMS directors have a medical group, so the state medical directors, and they put out what's really a quite good model protocol that's well referenced and well thought of or thoughtfully done that people use for guidelines. And so the NASEMSO guidelines are for adult traumatic and non-traumatic cardiac arrest, for advanced life support, cardiac arrest on EMS arrival in those patients that weren't hypothermic. For non-traumatic arrest, interestingly enough, they parsed this out based on not new literature, but existing generally agreed literature and evolving literature, and that if patients are asystolic or a slow wide PEA, because PEA is not necessarily PEA, that after 20 minutes of initiation, patients can get pronounced if there's no ROSC and if they have digital capnography using an endotracheal tube. They look differently upon patients with refractory ventricular fibrillation or with a narrow PEA, as I'm sure some of you have had the experience of something. You look and you say, that looks like they should have a pulse with that. That looks like PEA. It looks like that's sinus bradycardia with low cardiac output as opposed to PEA. And do we pronounce those on scene? And there's a, you know, still a need to say at some point those patients are not going to survive. So this model protocols look at that subset of populations differently, but again, identifying as are there other factors, other clinical, non-clinical factors that suggest that that patient's refractory or that's not going to survive and you can pronounce them. A traumatic cardiac arrest. We have not historically pronounced traumatic cardiac arrests in the field. Now, having said that, all of us have the experience that you get a call from EMS that we've got someone that's, I think Texas, they use DRT. They're dead right there. That somebody is has injuries that are incompatible with life. It's a blunt trauma arrest without evidence of the signs of life. Penetrating trauma without any signs of life at all, and those patients may well be candidates for field termination as well. And this national protocols, and there's a position statement from National Association of EMS Physicians and the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma that spells out in greater detail in terms of which patients should be pronounced on scene, and they lay out things like, again, no signs of life for penetrating trauma, greater than 15 minutes transport to a trauma center where somebody can open a chest or initiate a resuscitation, et cetera. But traumatic cardiac arrest is also part of this conversation, and those should be in conversation and collaboration with EMS and online medical direction. Final thoughts on field termination of resuscitation. There needs to be sort of another category where when the medics are there and there's 20 family members that are not going to take kindly to someone stopping on scene and leaving a loved one in the living room rather than taking them to the hospital, that if the medics think that it's unsafe, then they transport the patient. If there's logistical barriers to resuscitation or movement on scene, some of those patients can be taken to the hospital. System has to be in place to handle the deceased, so the police have to be part of this conversation. The medical examiner has to be in agreement to handle this decision. Most of that stuff, your EMS docs do that for you. If you're not involved with EMS at that level, you can thank your blessings, but you don't have to do that, but somebody needs to make sure that all of that's in place. And the providers, most importantly, need to have some sort of underlying training to break bad news. A number of you are involved with residency programs. There are a number of EPIC EM or other programs teaching residents how to break bad news to patients. And I think that's really important to give medics some background and some experience doing that. We had a conference where we brought in some actors and did a lecture and some training, and then had the medics in small groups break bad news to a patient who was calm and thoughtful and appreciative, and then another patient that was, or patient, another actress that, of course, lost it and was screaming, et cetera. But it was fun, and the medics greatly appreciated it. What's good to know about this is that Ted Dalbridge, actually maybe 30 years ago, did just a small pilot study and asked family members what they thought about somebody being pronounced on scene. And the family members said, we thought he was dead. We didn't know why they were working him at all. Or we thought the medics, you know, the medics worked a patient in the living room for a half hour. They came up. They were soaking wet. They were sweating. They came and said, we did it. They did everything they could for their loved one. And the family members were more accepting of the EMS personnel than they were sometimes in the emergency department. So it can be done, and it can be done well. I'll say only a word about what's called the Lazarus syndrome. Some of you have had this experience before. In fact, let me ask you, how many of you have pronounced a patient, walked away from the room, came back in, and initiated resuscitation again? So maybe a third, maybe a half of people. How many of you have had them go home? So you've pronounced somebody, walked away. Nurse says, doctor, I think they look like they're breathing, and start initiation, resuscitation, and then the patient gets resuscitated and gets admitted and goes home. We've had a few of those, of course, over the years. And there's some case studies written about patients that are pronounced. The EMS leaves. Somebody else comes, a medical examiner comes to take them to the morgue. And, of course, they open the shroud and the patient's breathing, et cetera. We had a case in the city of Detroit not too long ago that is good for our plaintiff's attorneys, as not much of anybody else, but was declared dead after about 30 minutes of CPR, taken to a funeral home and started breathing there. So real problem, and something that you have to deal with if you're dealing with a system of care in the field, and especially at home or in the emergency department. So how does this happen? Certainly there's a pseudo-PEA. There's certainly a group of patients that you pronounce. You say they don't have a pulse, but you put an ART line in and you see positive, you see flow, or you have cardiac activity on transthoracic ultrasound. So clearly that happens. Positive pressure ventilation, of course, decreases venous return, decreases cardiac output, and I'm firmly convinced that sometimes we just stop ventilating patients, and then they start getting blood flow back, or delayed transit, and of course, patients' difficulty palpating a pulse. So this is not just an EMS thing, but it's clearly an EMS thing when you leave a patient on scene, and you don't have a good a system to handle a problem should it arise. So that needs to be part. I'll say only a couple words about termination in the emergency department because there's not the same quantity and quality of literature of when do you pronounce somebody in the department, and that you'll have a resuscitation that somebody says, well, we've only been going 20 minutes, but they had 30 minutes of resuscitation in the field before they came, and that's not a different resuscitation. It's the same resuscitation. And you need to know when the clock started. You need to know what procedures were done in the field, if the patient had an advanced airway, if they had vascular access, if they had mechanical circulation. Some of those patients will have had a fairly substantial resuscitation in the field, but come into the emergency department and probably need to be evaluated quickly and pronounced. my approach to these is that if there's no flow in an arterial line, and I try to use art lines when I can for patients that look like they might have a pulse or look like they might have blood flow, bedside digital capnography if you have adequate end-tidal CO, if you have a end-tidal CO2 that's going up or it's in a range that you think you should really have blood flow, and then, of course, the Ds of do they have diapers, decubitize, DNR orders, do they have other things that you can't really write into policy in the field, that this person's been 75 and had myeloma for 15 years and on fourth level of chemotherapy, the termination in the emergency department, of course, is a lot more nuanced. I'll skip this in the interest of time, and I'll explain, say only that field termination of failed resuscitation is a best practice for EMS systems. It requires a degree of error proofing to make sure that you don't pronounce patients that might otherwise have some sort of meaningful circulation. You really need to spend time talking to your providers, providing training to breaking bad news and understanding the protocol. And the medics initially when we started doing this were extremely uncomfortable with the concept of, well, you're the doctor, that's what you get paid the big bucks for. But over time, they appreciate that they really can go up to a family member and say, I did everything I could. And the family's sitting there, if you've ever been on the field and you're doing CPR in somebody's living room and you're looking on the hearth and you see all the pictures of the patient that's on the floor with you with their daughters and sons and families, and the family's over in the dining room watching you do CPR, it's a pretty different experience. So it's way up front and personal. So I think the medics understand that and they appreciate that they can do that. CPR in progress in general has an ominous prognosis, and you should probably not put your providers at risk if they've given, if they've done everything they can in the field to do a resuscitation. And then termination should be based on failure to obtain cardiac resuscitation, not perceived neurologic prognosis. I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, well, they're not going to, they've been down 30 minutes anyway, they've got a neurologic injury. And this is the part I skipped, but a number of patients will have prolonged resuscitations, and especially now with some of the ECMO studies, well, they'll have 30, 45, 60 minutes of field resuscitation followed by ECMO, followed by resuscitation, and then I'll have intact neurologic survival. So I think what you have to do is you have to plan where they lie. If the patient fails cardiac resuscitation, they can be pronounced. But until you have a test that identifies what neurologic prognosis is at the time of the resuscitation, you need to make your resuscitation decisions based on cardiac care and not neurologic prognosis. Having said that, be happy to take questions. We got to take it where we can get them this year. We're happy. Thanks very much.